Argument, United States versus Whitaker, Mr. Mandel.
May it please the court, Ms. Rumbelow. I'm David Mandel, and I represent the appellant Lonnie Whitaker in this appeal of a circuit. District court decision denying a suppression motion. I believe that there was no reasonable suspicion that criminal activity was afoot or that Mr. Whitaker had a gun. I believe that it was error not to consider the Florida versus JL case on grounds which I think are quite specious, that there was no stop in this case as opposed to the stop in JL. Certainly, when the vehicle was approached by two marked police cars who pulled up directly behind the vehicle and the officers got out of the car and started walking towards the vehicle, I would say that that constitutes a stop, and I think the JL case is appropriate. I would also indicate
pretty
that I
clear these that people were not sitting there just enjoying the quietude of the evening.
Actually, they were just sitting there in the vehicle, and the police did not observe any arguing, anything unusual. They were just sitting in the vehicle. As they approached, they got out of the vehicle.
It was evidence that the female had been crying, was there not?
It was evidence on her T-shirt after she got out of the vehicle that it was wet and it appeared that she had been crying.
There was a van load of children in the car next door, is that right?
There was a van parked.
Next.
Yes. Parallel, there were some children in the van of the parties. But I don't think it's a crime to cry, nor is it a crime to have an argument with your significant other. Well, we'd all have a myriad of problems. I don't think this case is similar to Drake for a very important reason. In Drake, there was a predictability of movement. There was none in this case. In Drake, the caller, although not who identified herself, actually was on the phone observing an ongoing emergency situation and guided the officers in right to the point where they effectuated the arrest. That's distinguishable in this case because there was no ongoing emergency, and it was an anonymous call because the caller gave a false name and went out of his way to hide his identity. And there was no way for the police to verify.
Wasn't there another call, too?
Pardon?
Was there another call?
It was a first call that simply said, things are hot, there are two black males arguing in the parking lot. No mention of a gun.
Then there's a second 911 call.
There were two separate 911 calls. But the first one didn't describe any weapons, described two black males, and they don't really corroborate each other.
But when the officers got there, they had the information from the second call, didn't they?
No, they didn't. This is one of the major problems in the case, is that all of the information that the government relies on in their arguments and the court based part of its decision on was discovered long after the illegal search was conducted. They didn't have that information. All they received from dispatch was there were a man and a woman.
But we look at police as more an entity, and if probable cause existed, an individual cop doesn't have to know everything.
Right, but the only person that had the information was a civilian 911 dispatch person who's not law enforcement,
that doesn't have the training of
law enforcement.
What do you mean, not law enforcement? What kind of
civilian
training?
Employee hired by the county?
Police are civilians, for goodness sake. What training does the dispatcher have?
They have very little training.
Well, that's not an answer to my
question. Well, they don't have law enforcement training. They don't have
training. Well, of course they don't. They don't know how to shoot a gun, right? Okay.
I don't mean
what
that.
Kind of training do they have?
They are trained to receive the calls and then make calls via dispatch. They are not trained to determine probable cause, reasonable suspicion.
What kind of training do they get? Are they just telephone operators? Are they told something about the law?
They are basically telephone operators that are trained how to use a...
Do you know what kind of training they have? Is it in the record?
It's not in the record, but it's been in the newspapers as
well. Well, that's not very good. I mean, if you want to argue that 9/11 dispatchers shouldn't be treated as part of the police force, shouldn't you provide some evidence as to what kind of training they have?
Well, perhaps I should, Your Honor, but the fact of the matter is they weren't law enforcement personnel and they don't have the ability to share.
That's just semantic. What are law enforcement personnel?
Well, if you're going to rely on the collective knowledge doctrine that this is shared knowledge among law enforcement and you have a civilian telephone operator that receives a call.
I understand civilian. Police are not military people.
I use the word civilian to mean they are not
trained.
You
use it as a conclusion, but you haven't given us any facts that would enable us to determine whether these 9/11 operators have enough knowledge about law enforcement to be treated as part of the law enforcement community.
They don't go to any type of school for law enforcement. They're not trained in the principles.
You keep saying that, but you have no idea what training they get.
Well, I do, but I tried to offer that only because of a recent problem with the 9/11 operators. There's been a lot of articles in the newspaper, and they're generally just hired from the general public. They put out an advertisement. People apply for the job. If they're relatively intelligent, can operate a telephone, and can operate a radio, they can get the job. That's all they are. They're just, for lack of a better word, non-law enforcement individuals who got a county civil service job.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mandel. Ms. Rumbelow?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Rita Rumbelow for the United States. The District Court correctly found that there was no stop in this case. When the law enforcement officers approached the silver car in the blue van in the Cub Foods parking lot on Father's Day in 2007, Mr. Whitaker and Keisha Marsh both got out of the car. They both approached the police. And as this court is well aware, there's absolutely nothing that prohibits the police from approaching individuals in public places. That does not mean that it was a stop. The defendant then consented to a pat-down search. They didn't find anything. So what is that really at issue here is, did the police have reasonable suspicion to conduct the protective sweep of the silver car in the parking lot? And they did. It was overwhelming. They had two 911 calls. The first call was placed a little bit before 8 p.m., and it was a man who reported a loud, profane argument. The dispatcher asked for more detail. The man said he wasn't getting real close, but he thought it was like two heavy-set black males. So the dispatch told police about this argument. They were already on their way to the Cub Foods parking lot when then they received another dispatch call, which was also accompanied by an alert tone. The alert tone meant they had received a call regarding weapons.
So clearly was it clear to the arresting officers that there were two calls?
Oh, yes. Yes, the arresting officers were already on their way based on the first call. When they then received a second call, which corroborated the first call to the extent that there was an argument in the Cub Foods parking lot near a car. But the second caller, who had identified himself as Travis, provided a lot more detail. He said it was his female cousin and that the male was named Lonnie. They were by a silver car and a blue van, and that they had been engaged in a heated argument, which is, again, what the first caller had reported. So when the officers arrived, again, Lonnie Whitaker and Keisha Marsh just voluntarily come out of the car. Clearly, they wanted to try to, you know, delay the officers and not have them approach the car and find the gun. And when the officer Joswiak first encountered Keisha Marsh, the first thing he noticed is that the tears she had been crying so hard from this argument that the tear stain was very wide on her shirt. And then she, too, confirmed that she had been in an argument with Lonnie Whitaker. So under the totality of the facts, that in and of itself provided reasonable suspicion for Officer Joswiak to conduct the protective sweep of the car. But then one further detail is that when he actually told Keisha Marsh, he goes, "Miss Marsh, I'm going to conduct a search of the car for weapons," she wouldn't move. He physically had to get her out of the way. She didn't want him to enter the car. So clearly reasonable suspicion.
You keep using the word protective sweep. What's the difference between a protective sweep and a pat-down?
Well, the pat-down would more Well, it could be a pat-down of the car. I guess I think that just...
Well, I meant in terms of what you need, in terms of justification.
Nothing. You need reasonable suspicion for both. For both a pat-down of an individual and the protective sweep of the car for weapons.
Could the officers have taken into consideration the fact that this was a domestic argument? These things sometimes calm down and then flare up again. Did they take into consideration the danger to third parties at all? Is that a valid consideration?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Mr.
Is there precedent to back that up? I mean, it seems to me, looking at this thing, that for the officers to walk away in the middle of this domestic situation, knowing that these things, you know, getting called out twice in a domestic situation the same night is not unusual for these fellows. This thing could easily broil over again in the next 10 minutes. Knowing there's a van full of kids next door, and then in the car next door, and knowing that there may be a weapon in the car, take in consideration the fact, before you do the protective sweep, that there's a van full of kids next door. Is there any precedent that would support that? It seems to me a police officer would not be inclined to walk away from this situation.
Well, I think when Mr. Mandel talked about Drake involving an ongoing emergency, and he tried to distinguish this case, claiming this wasn't an ongoing emergency, I would beg to differ. I think it was, for all the reasons that you just stated. There's a van full of children. This is a public parking lot. You know, the public has, or two different people have already reported that, you know, there's this heated argument. One of them provided information that a weapon was involved, that Lonnie had actually waved the weapon at them, at the second 911 caller, saying, get away. And so the Keisha Marsh, the cousin, said, yeah, leave. That's why he didn't stay at the scene. He had a gun waved in his face when they tried to help the cousin. So he left and then called 911. That is an ongoing emergency. You've got the children there. You have the domestic dispute. Enough people in the public parking lot have seen this, reported it, and then the defendant waved the gun at one of them. So it's not distinguishable from Drake in any way regarding the ongoing emergency.
What do you do with the Second Circuit case, Colon? It seems to cast doubt on whether we can look at so-called unsworn officers manning emergency lines.
Well, I don't think it does, because in Drake, this court held that under the collective knowledge doctrine, the 911 operators are part of the law enforcement community, and of course they're part of the law enforcement community. They are stationed at the Dane County Sheriff's Department. Judge Posner, I don't think there is any evidence in the record, well, there isn't, regarding what specific training they get. But in this case, remember, after the first call, they just told the officers, look, respond to an argument. The second call then was accompanied by an alert tone, because Lonnie Whitaker had waved this gun at the second 911 caller. So clearly they received some sort of training to, you know, let the police know when the situation has, you know, heightened. So I think that they are definitely part of the law enforcement community, and that enough facts, even if you take away the facts that weren't relayed to the officers who were responding, there still was enough, because we had two 911 calls in this case, and everything that they said was corroborated when the officers arrived at the scene.
Can we factually distinguish the Second Circuit case?
No, I don't think so. I just think that they differ from this court.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Rumbelow.
And
yes, okay.
First of all, when the officer asked Ms. Marsh if they had been arguing, it was already after the search had taken place. Secondly, they had already said they were going to search the vehicle and intent and move to search the vehicle when she stood there, so I think it doesn't really matter. And finally, the 911 center is not in the Sheriff's Department. It's located in the city-county building. It's not manned as part of a law enforcement agency. Thank
you. Okay, thank
you
very much. And Mr. Mandel, you were appointed, were you not? So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client. We thank Ms. Rumbelow also. Last case.